It's my pleasure to introduce you to your colleagues and friends, Professor Muir Humphreys and Professor Colin Scott. Muir is the director of the Center for Indigenous Nutrition and Environment, and Colin is a professor in anthropology. They will co-chair the first session of our conference on food security in Canada. Thank you very much for your help and welcome.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to co-chair this session along with Colin Scott. We're just going to be loading two presentations as I speak briefly. So I'll take the opportunity to introduce both of our first two presenters as part of the session with their biographies. It's a real opportunity here for us to shift the focus a little bit from the last presentation on global food security and connections to agriculture to look at food security within a Canadian context. Whereas you're about to see, the issues are similar in many ways, but also highlight some unique features of the issue of food insecurity in Canada. Our session will focus in particular on northern peoples and Indigenous peoples and the food insecurity problems within Canadian cities. Our first presenter will be Trina Delormier. Trina is an assistant professor of public health at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and she's training students in the first of its kind Native Hawaiian and Indigenous health specialization. For the past 20 years, Trina has been involved with the Kaneohe School's Diabetes Prevention Project in the South Shore Mohawk community of Kaneohe as a research team and community advisory board member. She was a member of the Canadian Council of Academies expert panel that completed the 2014 assessment Aboriginal Food Security in Northern Canada, a State of Knowledge. Her research is primarily community-based with Indigenous communities, uses participatory approaches and privileges, Indigenous knowledge frameworks. Dr. Delorme's research interests include food, nutrition and health, social perspectives of food, Indigenous research methodologies, qualitative methodologies, public health and health promotion. Dr. Delormier holds a bachelor's degree in nutrition from McGill University, is a registered dietitian in Quebec. She completed her master's research in nutrition at McGill University's Center for Indigenous Peoples, Nutrition and Environment, and she has a PhD in public health from the University of Montreal. And our second presenter, Naomi Dachner, which is there, but you can wait there for now, is... You ready to go a little bit? No problem. Is a research manager in the Department of Nutritional Sciences, Faculty of Medicine at University of Toronto. She holds a master's from the University of Toronto and completed a BSc in Nutrition and Dietetics at Ryerson University and a BA in North American Studies at McGill University. Since her master's research, which was an ethnography of food access among homeless squeegee kids in Toronto, Naomi has continued her involvement with research in the area of food insecurity, working with Professor Valerie Teresik and members of her research group. Currently, Naomi coordinates PROOF, which is a five-year interdisciplinary program of research funded by a CHR program grant to tackle health and health equity. PROOF researchers have embarked on a program of research to delineate the conditions that produce and mitigate household food insecurity, define the health burden and cost of food insecurity in Canada, and elucidate the effects of specific policy interventions. At the same time, PROOF aims to raise awareness of the problem and build capacity in interdisciplinary research and policy analysis on food insecurity.
Thank you. Okay. I just had to upgrade the flash player. Didn't expect to do that. Okay. I'm just going to load my Prezi. The great thing about this is if it works. All right. Let me just start from the beginning again because. All right. Firefox again? Okay, so while he's resetting the browser, I just wanted to say, Segun Zewa Gwegun Watskwerun Adum, Bienvenue tout le monde, and welcome to everyone. Because I'm a Ganyogehaga citizen, I'm a citizen of the Mohawk Nation, it's my responsibility to welcome you to our traditional territory. Historically, this was Ganyogehaga territory, so it's my responsibility to do that. I hope everyone had a safe trip getting here and arriving here, and I hope we have very good meeting today and gathering today. And when we're done, I wish you all a safe trip back to your families, wherever they may be and wherever your travels take you back home. In our program with at the Native Hawaiian Indigenous Health Program, MPH, at University of Hawaii at Manoa, we have all the students use Prezi, and I was a PowerPoint person, so I had to get used to this, and it's actually quite fun. Okay, so let me make sure I don't forget to say anything important. When I'm going to be talking in my talk today, I'm going to be using the terms Aboriginal, because as some of you might be familiar, Aboriginal describes the three groups of indigenous people in Canada: First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. But I often use indigenous because within an international context, this is the term to describe people who have cultural continuity, who have a historical relationship with the territories and places that they are inhabiting. So I just want to make those two distinctions. And I'm going to start my talk about Aboriginal food security in northern Canada, but I really want to take it to a public health perspective on what do we do with this information that we have on the situation with food insecurity for Aboriginal people in the north, and in terms of what's the actions that we need to move toward. So just before I begin, I wanted to give you a little bit of my perspective to let you know where I'm coming from on this issue, because as Dr. Humphrey said, I'm bringing a different perspective from what we've been hearing about yesterday and this morning. And my background is as I'm trained as a researcher from a community-based perspective. As was said, I spent 20 years, and I'm still working with the Ganawagi Schools Diabetes Prevention Project. But it's within that lab or that space, that context, that I was trained to do research that would serve communities, that would respect Indigenous knowledge and understandings of our place as Indigenous people in the world, and to use that knowledge to action. So not just collecting information for the sake of information's sake, but to use knowledge for informing actions that are going to be beneficial to Indigenous communities. This is just a picture of us having a meeting discussing a manuscript with some community members. And then a more relevant and the specific perspective I bring today was as a participant on the expert panel on the State of Knowledge on Aboriginal Food Security in Northern Canada. And we can see, oh, you weren't in this picture, Marie. Most of the members, not all of the members, were there. And Dr. Harriet Kuhnlein was the chair of that panel, and she was also my supervisor for my master's degree, where I did research with the James Bay Cree in northern Quebec, and got exposed to, you know, nutrition transition by documenting traditional food use. And then more recently, oops, I'm not using the proper... My role as a trainer, as a teacher, as a professor in the Native Hawaiian Indigenous Health MPH program. And these are some of our students in the program. And there we really focus on preparing and training a workforce who can take these understandings of what the issues are, place them in their historical context so that they can understand the health inequalities from a public health perspective, but then use those public health tools in service to the community. And this is one of our activities where we take a hike to, you know, just be out in the beautiful environment there, but also to learn about each other and what each other's interests are. So those are my perspectives now, trying to figure out what do we take, how do I train students, how do I take this knowledge and move it into action. So I just want to draw on a few pieces of evidence from the report that we worked on with the Council of Canadian Academies. And, you know, I think the message should be, the message was pretty clear from this report that there's a serious crisis of food insecurity in northern Canada, especially when we're talking about Aboriginal populations. And please refer to that report if you haven't already, because it's really well done. There's a lot of information that's very useful. And in this graph, we see probably some of the most comprehensive assessment of food insecurity for northern Aboriginal peoples that was done by Dr. Grace Eglund. And we have it compared to all Canadian households data. So we can see very clearly the inequalities there, that the fact of what proportion of households are both moderately and severely food insecure. But I also wanted to point out that it's not the only surveys. There have been other studies done, and there are ongoing surveys being done right now to monitor the situation with food insecurity in other First Nations communities that are not necessarily in the geographic north, but are in remote communities. And for, if you can, I put the website for the First Nations Environment and Nutrition and Environment Study that's completed three surveys so far, one in Ontario, Manitoba, and BC. And they're finding similar results, that the level of food insecurity is quite severe. The First Nations Regional Health Survey that was done from 2008 to 2010 also found over half of households that they, it's quite a comprehensive and includes many households, they found similar results as well. So we know that there's a serious problem. And we also know that if we look at the likelihood characteristics of household and their likelihood of being food insecure, there's certain overrepresentations. I mean, being Aboriginal is overrepresented. If just that fact, having that ethnicity, means that more households who claim that ethnicity are food insecure, but many of them are related to income and social policies that would impact income, like earning an income below the income measure, having social assistance as your major source of income, or relying on employment insurance or workman's compensation. Those households are overrepresented. And I find those sorts of analysis of the social factors that are related to food insecurity is helpful for the social determinants perspective on health. This is something that for those of you in public health are very familiar with, and some maybe so familiar with, but it helps us to understand what these distant social factors, or the way, you know, the characteristics of society and how society is organized impacts health on a very individual level. So this is just a model of some of those factors, like environmental conditions, socioeconomic conditions, work environments, education, and how these contexts and conditions can have an impact on health capacities, health behaviors, health management, that all have an impact on health status. So food insecurity fits within there. And it's a useful, what I find useful for this tool is it helps to explain what the many factors can be, and we know these problems can be complex. And when we were working on the report, we felt it was necessary to conceptualize these many factors that are involved with features of northern Aboriginal food security. And, you know, you can also, on the website, there's a really good explanation of this, so I don't want to go into details about it, but it was important for us when we were addressing this issue to put northern Aboriginal peoples at the center. So this isn't a phenomenon without, you know, people at the center who are experiencing this on a daily life, a daily basis. We also wanted to acknowledge the historical context of colonialism and how that's dispossessed people from lands and denied them access to practice their cultural practices and being who they are on their land. It was important for us to also include food sovereignty and the notion of human rights and governance as part of this, addressing this issue. So to finish off, how do we move forward? In the report, we talked about the need for multi-level and multidisciplinary strategies. And these included strategies that look at poverty reduction and economic development. We need programs to increase food access and availability. There's examples in for each of these strategies. One is Growing Forward in Manitoba. Health and educational programs, for example, food guides, nutrition education programs, cooking courses. We have a lot of good examples of those. strategies that address community wellness, so not just food insecurity, but community wellness and intergenerational knowledge sharing, harvester support and sustainable wildlife management, innovation infrastructure and local food production, as well as engaging youth and empowering them. And then to close off, the way I see this and how I would translate it to my students or to communities where we want to work on projects is that we need to build upon community strategy, strengths and assets. We have to start where the community is at. And this means valuing Indigenous perspectives, their knowledge, and their governance. It means realizing, not just recognizing the rights of Indigenous peoples, and we have the UN Declaration of Rights on Indigenous Peoples to guide us as the minimal standard for rights. We need to address the distinct implications of the historical context of colonialism and newer forms of colonialism in the Aboriginal context. And we also have to empower Indigenous self-governance toward reclaiming land, to practice stewardship, and to reaffirm identity. Thank you very much.
So we'll have opportunity for questions at the end of all three presentations. So we'll just segue directly into Naomi Dackner, and just a reminder again that she's from Department of Nutritional Sciences at University of Toronto.
Hi, thank you. So the problem that I'm going to be talking about today is household food insecurity, and that's defined as insecure and inadequate access to food due to financial constraints. It's commonly referred to as hunger, a term that's really been defined through the lens of food banks in our country, which really is the public face of the problem here in Canada. But it's a problem that is monitored by Statistics Canada through their Canadian Community Health Survey, and we've had a consistent measurement tool since 2004. There were other tools before, but since 2004, we've actually been able to monitor the problem over time through an 18-item questionnaire that describes families' experiences with food deprivation. And it runs through a range of experiences, the most mildest or least extreme worry or anxiety about running out of food or not having enough money to be able to buy the food that one's family needs, through to qualitative compromises in dietary choices, and then at the most extreme or severe end, going for periods of time without food, so for whole days even. And the tool distinguishes between adults and children's experience in the households because there's a very, very well-developed literature that says that adults will go to great lengths to protect their children and go without food long before they have to cut back on their children's food. A very important point to make is that each of the 18 statements follow with the clause because there wasn't enough money for food. And this allows us to know that what we're talking about is food insecurity and not a cultural choice or a diet even. So it is a household measure, and what you see on this slide on the vertical axis is a number of households in Canada, so this is national data, experiencing food insecurity over a four-year period. And what you can see here is that there's been an increase from 2007 to 2012, and this increase is actually significant. Each of these bars are broken down by levels of severity, so using the 18-item questionnaire, we can categorize people as either marginally, moderate, or severely food insecure. And you might notice it's a little bit, I think Trina mentioned moderate and severe, so the categorization is a little bit different with an additional category of marginal. So what this translates into is nearly 13% of Canadian households facing food insecurity, or 4 million people within these households. And this 4 million is definitely an underestimate of the problem because the Canadian Community Health Survey doesn't interview people who, or doesn't include people who are homeless, off-reserve Aboriginals, and other remote communities in our country. There's quite a range across the provinces. These are the provincial prevalences, with Canada at the top, just to remind you of the national one. Oops, I keep touching things. Okay. What you see here is that it's a problem in every province. It doesn't fall below 11.5%. 11.5% we're doing the best in Alberta in 2012. Rates are higher in the eastern parts of the country, and then, of course, most prevalent in the north. In particular, Nunavut here, look at over 45% of people in Nunavut. And this would exclude many of the people that Trina reported on. But another important way to look at the problem, I think, from a policy and programmatic perspective is to look at the actual numbers, which give us some idea of where the problem lies, the density of the problem. So here you see the provinces lined up again, and instead of prevalence rates, we've got the number of households experiencing the problem. And you can see, not surprisingly, that the density of the problem lies in our most populous provinces, which is sort of a very stark thing to think about if you think about wiping out, if we were even able to wipe out the problem of food insecurity in Nunavut, which we absolutely should do, we wouldn't put a dent in the overall prevalence of the problem in the country. So we're dealing with a serious and big problem in Canada. So, and why do we care about food insecurity? Well, food insecurity is inextricably linked to health. Food insecure individuals are vulnerable to health compromises across a range of measures. Any physical, social, or mental health measure, food insecure individuals score poorly. There is a bunch of different ways that we can look at the relationship between health and food insecurity, and I'm choosing one way to show you because this is a piece of work that is quite novel and something we're just wrapping up, where we've looked at healthcare utilization and costs associated with food insecurity using Ontario data. So we have the CCHS that has the food security questionnaire, that data linked to OHIP records, so Ontario's health insurance program. And what you can see here is the average per capita health care costs over a year period, so the same period that people were reflecting on their food insecurity experience, for Ontario residents 12 years and older. And you can see a very, very strong graded relationship between food insecurity and health or health care costs, where severely food insecure individuals are costing nearly 2.5 times that of food secure individuals. So not only is the problem taking a toll at the individual level in terms of health, but as a society, we're paying more money to people who are food insecure. So who is food insecure? Well, our single best predictor of the problem is household income. So when we look at surveys, household income is always the strongest predictor. And what you can see on this graph is that relationship. So as household income increases, the prevalence of food insecurity decreases. And the other thing that I'd like to point out is that it's not a perfect relationship. So even when we look at the lowest level of household income here, we see the prevalence doesn't shoot up to 100, it's around 46%. And this is because food insecurity really captures a level of material deprivation that isn't totally captured by income, which is the best variable we have on these surveys. It's the product of a household's assets and savings, their access to credit, shelter costs, and other expenses. So anything that, you know, would affect their material circumstances. When we look at households by their main source of income, we start to see the connections to social policy in our country. So households that are reliant on, the problem of food insecure, most of the people who are food insecure in our country are reliant on employment income. So this isn't a problem of unemployment, rather a problem probably related to the type of employment that's available out there. But it also speaks to the inadequacy of our current income transfer system. So through taxation, low-wage earners are entitled to exemptions and credits, which are meant to offset their low income. And at least from the perspective of food insecurity, we see this isn't happening, it's not happening in a good enough way. Seniors are another interesting example from social policy perspective. Households that are reliant on seniors' income are protected from food insecurity. They're the only group that surfaces this way. Only 7% of these households are food insecure versus 11% of working households. And unlike any other group, if you think about it, seniors in our country enjoy a guaranteed annual income through the GIS, through old age security. And this income is indexed to inflation. They also enjoy drug coverage, transit subsidies, and other host of seniors' day type discounts in the community. But we've really, as a country, I think, worked hard to improve the lot of seniors, and from the perspective of food insecurity, at least, this is borne out. The impact of social policy can also be seen if we look at social assistance recipients. And social assistance recipients are well known to be a very vulnerable group to the problem. Nationally, 70% of social assistance recipients are food insecure. And what you can see here is the range in the provinces, with Alberta having the highest prevalence among social assistance recipients, and then Newfoundland and Labrador, which jumps out, well, I've made it jump out, with 46.2%. And when we first saw these results, we were interested in sort of figuring out what was going on in Newfoundland, what else could we learn to see why this rate was so much lower, since the problem is so prevalent among social assistance recipients. So we took a look at Newfoundland, and what we saw was over a period of time, 2007 to 2012, there was a systematic decline and a significant decline in prevalence rates among social assistance recipients, almost cut by half in 2012. And this is the exact period of time as their rollout of their poverty reduction strategy in that province. And there have been a few provinces with poverty reduction strategies, but the Newfoundland one appears to be it was an aggressive strategy, and it appears to be successful because we don't see this impact in any other province. We can't isolate the effects of any one measure that they took because we just don't have the data to do that, but the fact that, this we see this decline at the same period of time is strongly suggestive. And again, I just want to point out, none of these policies were intended to reduce food insecurity. This is us out there trying to figure out what types of policies can we look at that could lead us in directions to help this problem in Canada. So even though we know quite a bit about the problem, who's most vulnerable to it, we also have some insights into policy directions, the main response to this problem in our country remains charitable, extra-governmental, largely through food banks. So if your household is in a situation where you have no money for food, you can go to a food bank. There's some meal programs also. And there are also some other community-based programs that were that emerged sort of in response, I think in part response to some of the limitations of food banks, so stigma and trying to encourage participation. So these are things like community kitchens, gardens, farmers markets, et cetera, and whose program food insecurity or ameliorating food insecurity isn't necessarily the primary goal of these programs. The goal is really to increase food access to nutritious foods among low-income groups who may be vulnerable to food insecurity. So there's been some work to look at the effectiveness of these responses, and sadly, they don't appear to be effective. They're very poorly attended, serving a fraction of those who are struggling with the problem. So food bank use, most food insecure households don't use food banks, less than a quarter, and the participation rates for people in, for garden programs and kitchens is much, much lower. Work that's looked at the impact of these programs on food insecurity has not found them to address the problem, so people who are food insecure are just as likely to be food insecure after they've used a food bank or participated in these programs. And by design, they're not designed to address the root causes of food insecurity. So hopefully I've told you a little bit about the problem and showed you some promising policy directions. This is what our group, as was said in the introduction, this is what we're charged to do, to look for policy interventions to reduce food insecurity. So if you're interested in more information, that's our website. Thank you.
Okay, so now with our final presentation, Colin Scott and I will co-present. Just a little indication of where we're taking you. I hope that through this session we're highlighting to you perhaps the surprising magnitude of the food insecurity problem in Canada. And we also really want to highlight the diversity of contributors to that. And we've kind of on purpose gone from the north and Trina's focus on the north to Naomi's focus on urban areas and poverty and food bank kind of context of the problem. And now we're going to switch gears quite completely and head back to the north and focus on some other determinants of food insecurity in the north that are much more indirectly related to the direct issue of food. And now we're going to talk about wildlife and lands. So our presentation will be wildlife, land, and environmental stewardship as contributors to food security in northern Canada.
So, as Murray has just alluded to, he and I work in contexts in which there's very little scope, really, to think about agriculture as a solution to food insecurity. Subarctic and Arctic environments, where, well, in the subarctic, a few Anglican and Catholic missionaries grew a little bit of rye and seeded some potatoes in small plots to keep one or two animals alive around missions and posts. But that's about the extent of agriculture. Generally, the geography, the climate are not amenable to agricultural production. So food security in the north, in the Canadian north, and in other circumpolar parts of the globe, is more about wildlife, the management of wildlife, the preservation of habitats where wildlife can flourish and where indigenous activities, economic activities can endure. Northern Canada is not remote, unoccupied territory. It's never been remote and unoccupied territory from the perspective of indigenous folks. But neither is it remote and unoccupied, really, from the perspective of mainstream society anymore. And when we look at the example of Quebec, many of you will be familiar with the Plan Nord, Quebec's northern plan, and it is billed really as a big push to development in the north, economic, social, and environmental projects are mentioned, but there is certainly a major emphasis on capital investment, on industrial resource extractive forms of development, on the creation of 20,000 jobs a year, and jobs from the perspective of northern indigenous people are important and are importantly linked to food security, but it's a complex linkage to the ways in which jobs articulate with people's continued use of the land. The northern plan applies to all of Quebec north of the 49th parallel, and I'm from Saskatchewan, so for me the 49th parallel was the border with the United States, and I don't think of it as particularly north, but ecologically, the 49th parallel in Quebec is quite far north. It's well up into the subarctic. Although it's over 70% of Quebec's landmass, it contains 2% of Quebec's population. Turning to Indigenous folks that I've worked with, these are Cree women in a traditional structure on the coast of James Bay processing speckled trout and whitefish. Here are some of their relatives, men engaged in the spring waterfowl hunt. These are activities which have endured and do endure, but with some major challenges stemming in part from industrial development in this environment, in particular hydroelectric extraction. Just to put this in demographic context, Northern Canada more broadly is home to 120,000 people in the territories, and if you include the northern provinces, over 200,000 people, a small fraction of the Canadian population, but a not insubstantial population, and one that has a major presence in the equation of development because it's has a high percentage of Indigenous folks who have strong rights and entitlements in regard to the development of natural resources. Part two.
So the second point we wanted to make was that, and it's many of you will be already aware of this, but traditional food is an important contributor to food security in northern Canada. Definition of traditional food would be plants and animals that are harvested locally and eaten by people. And it's important to recognize that traditional food system is not just about food, but it provides, you know, not only the nutritional benefits, but is deeply connected with community ethics and identity. The traditional food system is a cultural strength, integral not only to the cultural, but to the social and economic lives of individuals and communities. There has been a nutrition transition in the north. There's been, you know, increasing incorporation of market foods. But the traditional food system remains integral to issues of food security and questions of food insecurity in northern Canada. you can see these in the same statistics that are reported in the Canadian Council review that Trina referred to, and looking at the consumption, the percent of Inuit across Nunavut who consumed country food. Country food is the preferred term in Inuit regions and traditional food in other parts of the north with primarily First Nations. But something like 60% of people consume marine mammal fat. And up to 80% in certain seasons of marine mammal meat. And birds can be consumed in spring by almost 90% of the population. And fish and seafood, more than 90%. And land animals, more than 90%. I want to start to highlight the diversity of the species that are consumed and the seasonal variation in those species and when they're consumed. Another part of the north where I've worked quite a bit is in northern Yukon in Old Crow, and this is the home of the Vuntut Gwich'in First Nation. And the First Nation symbol incorporates a caribou as part of their identity, and this is because these are the people of the lakes, and that top right picture refers to the lake, which is a region called Old Crow Flats, but it's also the people of the Porcupine Caribou Herd. And this is a small, remote fly-in community, 250 people. Look at the food frequency questionnaire that was conducted by Laurie Chan and collaborators from the University of Northern British Columbia at the time. The average citizen in Old Crow, and this is recent data in the last couple of years, eat caribou 204 days of the year. The next most common consumed species is Chinook salmon 48 days out of the year, moose 32, lake whitefish, fish eggs, coho, chum, fish liver, arctic grayling, duck, burbot, geese, round whitefish, muskrat, rabbit, and so on. Incredible diversity of food and a heavy reliance on those food species. Harriet Kuhnlein and I have recently completed a book on the indigenous foods, the traditional animal foods of indigenous peoples in northern North America. We've documented through lots of looking back at old ethnographies, descriptions of food use and harvest practice of indigenous peoples across North America, more than 500 different species of mammals, birds, fish, shellfish, and other animals used as traditional food, everything ranging from bears to caribou to waterfowl to pike to ptarmigan to shellfish to squid and octopus for coastal peoples. Just an incredible diversity of foods used. When we're talking about traditional food in the north, we're not just talking about caribou, we're not just talking about beluga, we're talking about an incredible diversity. Some of that diversity can be captured in a harvest calendar. The text will be hard to see, but the point here is that there's many different species harvested at different times of the year according to their availability, nutritional suitability, sometimes according to the lack of availability of other species. Harvest tends to focus on some species that are available year-round at times of year when opportunities to harvest other species are less. So that we need to recognize that traditional food availability varies day-to-day, season-to-season, year-to-year, and from one region to the next. So there's a lot of diversity in the traditional food system. The third is that traditional food security requires a bunch of factors to be in place. You need access to land. You need the biodiversity to be present on that land, and you need the cultural continuity in terms of harvest practice and opportunity and local knowledge to be out on the land. And all of that has to be maintained in an era of rapid environmental change. Could highlight this, we could focus on any part of the north, and the particular species involved, the particular impacts and the challenges involved will be different, but the same general themes will emerge. And I'll give you just one case study from the coast of James Bay with the James Bay Cree. So in particular, if we looked at the region around Chisasibi, a community in northern Quebec, the Bay of Many Islands. In this part, all along the eastern James Bay as well as western James Bay, coastal waterfowl is incredibly important to the Cree. If you look at the symbols that many of the First Nations use, there's often a goose somewhere figured prominently. These are waterfowl harvested primarily along the coast at migratory stopover sites, both on the flight north in the spring and the flight south in the fall. The key species of harvested, the migratory waterfowl there, were brant and Canada geese. Both these species, but brant in particular, depend extensively on eelgrass, which is a keystone ecosystem along the eastern James Bay coast, a very shallow ecosystem with lots of bays and islands and shallow waters. And eelgrass grows in those shallow waters. And brant in particular is a specialist on that eelgrass community. something happened in the mid-1990s, and this is plots of different locations. You'll see the small green bars, and those are biomass of eelgrass at long-term monitor stations between 1988 and 2009, and you'll see in about the mid-1990s, the eelgrass disappeared, and it really hasn't come back. In a couple of locations, it's come back to some extent, but it's really gone. Why did the eelgrass disappear? It's unclear. There's a couple of major hypotheses. One of them is that there's been a lot of hydroelectric development. Many of you will be familiar with the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement. There's a long history of hydroelectric development in this region. That's a complex land claims, one of the first kind of modern treaties in North America that specifies lands and access to lands from a category 1 to 2 to 3. And has diversions and very massive changes to the ecosystem along the East James Bay. Part of that was the massive Le Grand complex and reservoir diversions associated with it, which has changed freshwater discharge patterns into the James Bay. And one of the major hypotheses for the declines of eelgrass is shifting water quality, shifting salinity, shifting turbidity associated with some of that development. Of course, there's also been climate change proceeding and global eelgrass declines is a concern. Whatever the cause, the eelgrass is gone and the brant are gone. They're not there. The brant populations, the harvests of brant used to number in the thousands, and there's essentially no brant harvest occurring along the East James Bay coast anymore. And the Canada geese harvest has shifted. Now it's most what Canada geese are there are resident so-called long necks, as the Cree refer to them, not the migratory short necks that used to come. And much of the harvest of those geese has shifted inland away from the coast. This picture in the bottom is a hunting camp, a goose hunting camp, in the 1970s, 80s, 90s heyday of goose harvest. And I don't know if you can see, and it's a little small, but those are freighter canoes and hundreds of hunters occupying that camp. I had the opportunity to visit that camp recently with my family. It's abandoned. There's no hunters there. There's no waterfowl hunting happening. We traveled the bay. There's no eelgrass. There's no brant. As our host, George Laneboy, who brought us there to show us, you know, the James Bay Agreement specifies guaranteed harvest levels. And we can certainly promote the benefits of traditional food in the food insecurity problem in the north. But what good are those promotions and agreements when the wildlife and the ecosystems are gone? Food insecurity, food security depends on integrated ecosystems, biodiversity conservation, and access and cultural continuity to be intact in the north.
So all of this, I think, brings our attention to the point, the fourth point that we'll speak to, that when health and identity depend on land and wildlife, the usual models of development involving premises of open-ended growth, wealth creation, need to be reconsidered, and along with those models, our approach to environmental protection. The Cree example provides some tools for thinking about development in a different way, an alternative model of development, if you like, one which focuses on quality of life within living, total living communities. Crees have a term for these total living community, Matsyun. It can be simply translated as life, but it also refers philosophically to the continuous birthing of the world. Its human occupation is on this threshold of the continuous birthing of the world, and human responsibility is about maintaining the complex web of relationships. So there's an ethic, an environmental ethic of respect for relationships of mutuality and reciprocity, mutual responsibility, linking all life forms. And the concept of health in Cree, which one of my former students and colleagues, Naomi Adelson, has written about miyumatsiyun, living well, being alive well, I think, as Naomi translates it, is fundamental to the idea of living well, is pursuing the activities of hunting, of fishing, of trapping, of eating food from the land. For many Crees, particularly middle-aged and elderly Crees, but some young people are adopting similar perspectives. Food from the store is not real food. Real food is food from the land. Strong food is food from the land. Land that makes you that restores health is food from the land. One of the things that Murray and I have been involved with the Crees is a community-based strategy for environmental protection, for establishing a network of protected areas, land and sea protected areas, which would be defined as coherent and coherent with and supportive of Cree livelihood activities. And this is just a map which shows some of the various categories of provincial, mainly provincial Quebec protected areas, which the Crees have been involved in establishing. And offshore, there's a bounded in dark blue. You'll see a large segment of James Bay, which is covered by a recent. It's called the EU Marine Region Agreement, which was signed about 4 years ago, dealing with Aboriginal title to the offshore. And Crees are now in discussion amongst themselves and with the federal government about turning the majority of that area into a national marine conservation area. And part of the motivation for that is not just to protect what remains, but is to focus attention on what is a precious ecological driver for the larger Hudson Bay ecosystem. And we hope to generate the kinds of research funding that would be necessary to really understand some of the dynamics that Murray has referred to with respect to hydro, with respect to climate change, and to engage in some serious restoration of the James Bay marine ecosystem. Here's another shot which gives you a larger perspective on some of the protected areas initiatives that have been happening in Quebec, in Ontario, and Manitoba, and Labrador around this Hudson Bay region. So, in closing, the vision that Crees would put forward in pursuing this agenda, and I think it's quite compatible, quite congruent with the kinds of initiatives that Indigenous people in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, are pursuing. The notion that development is to be measured by quality of life, miyumatsiyun, and the quality of life not just from a human-centric perspective, but from the perspective of accommodating the complexity and diversity of that community of life that Crees refer to as Madsiyun, and to do that comprehensively throughout the entirety of the Crees forest and coastal and marine environment. Thanks.
Thank you. So if we could ask the first two presenters to come up, they can have a seat. I can just stay standing here. And we'd be very happy to take any questions for each of the presenters separately or collectively to the panel. If we just ask you to come to the mic and indicate if you're targeting this at everyone collectively or one of our presenters. And remember that this is Naomi and Trina and Colin and Murray.
Thank you very much. It was enjoyable to look at some of the problems that we have in Canada. The northern part, certainly the concept, the philosophical approach is quite important. Recently, one of our graduates from McGill went on to do PhD. Her PhD thesis is in North. So she wrote back to me a long email saying that, Dr. Raghavan, you are being involved in post-harvest technology around the globe, but my project points out to me not having the right way of storing caribou meat when it is hunted and then the not existence of the proper technological thing. At times, they do not have the food that is required. So it's a complex situation when I just heard about the concept of philosophical approaches of the society, but then how do you see, how do I make a little connection to bring the technological aspect of it so that the food is still safe and it is available throughout? I would like to hear from you.
My experience with Cree hunters spans 40 years now, and there have been a lot of technological changes in Cree hunting. The philosophical system has been quite enduring, and there's been lots of continuity. And in terms of social relations and human-animal relations, there have been many continuities. There are also some worrisome possible interruptions in those relationships. But to come to your point about technology, people, for example, have really embraced, going back to the 1930s, charter aircraft, bush planes, increasingly road vehicles as hydro and forestry activities have made road access possible, all-terrain vehicles. And a lot of this is about being able to get the meat out of the bush and into freezers. And that has, it has substantially affected the ability of people to consume certain foods that are available in abundance year-round. And also it has facilitated distribution. It used to be that families who were on the land in hunting camps could share with a limited locus of neighbors. But now, when large harvests are made of two or three moose, for example, they can take that meat back to the community and feed a large portion of the community. These animal products are put into ceremonial occasions. They support weddings and so on.
I think I would just add quick, you know, that it's a hybrid of solutions. So certainly in my Old Crow experience, there's community freezers, there's, you know, some investment in community-wide infrastructure to help facilitate meat storage. But at the same time, you walk into a household and there's dry meat drying over top of the fire. And so here's a fireplace and a house and they've got caribou meat. And so dry meat is you know, a very old technique of drying thin pieces of meat that don't require refrigeration, and hunters still very much out on the land have a bag full of dry meat with them. So it's, you know, just a little bit like the nutrition transition. It's incorporation of new technology. I showed you the picture of us on the coast in James Bay, and that particular hunter had a generator that he brought with us and used it to run a freezer to keep the fish frozen while we, you know, until we got back to town. So I think there's definitely opportunities for innovation, for use of technology, but like experience of everybody in the room in different parts of the world, it's always a matter of having those initiatives community-led, bottom-up, incorporating local practice and knowledge systems and ways of proceeding. You can't impose it from the top.
Trina? Yeah, and I just wanted to add on that point. Because of the history of researchers going into indigenous communities and taking information, taking data, that's changed, fortunately, a lot. But sometimes there's this perspective of experts coming in to solve problems in communities. And, you know, it takes time to establish relationships, trusting relationships where people can work together to address these kind of issues, whether it be technological transfer or whether it's going to be health issues, but really, you know, investing in time with the community to understand the context, to be able to figure out what's going to best fit with communities.
Question here.
Hi, my name is Aliza, and I'm an IDS graduate from Mayo. And my question is for Dr. Delormier. You spoke about various ways of dealing with food security among Aboriginals. I mentioned that historical colonialism and modern colonial factors must be addressed to fulfill the aims of food security. And I was just wondering, what are some of those modern colonial factors that you mentioned before?
So I would... For me, things that were brought up in terms of how development is being, how it's being envisioned for Canada, you know, and how it impacts Indigenous communities. So those sorts of models I see as new forms of colonialism, neocolonialism, because it's continuing the idea of, or it's continuing dispossessing people from lands, removing them from lands, or denying access to their territories. And I think the examples that we saw for Northern Quebec with the Cree shows how some of that development can impact not just access to land, but then the resources on that land. So when we think about colonialism, I always think of two things. It's land, having access to land and reclaiming that access. So that's how we would address colonialism, and governance. So who is making the decisions? And if Indigenous people are not included in the decision making, you know, those are examples of how we can see or assess new forms of colonialism.
Hi, my name is Marius. I'd first like to recognize the ongoing hospitality of the Kanigiage people. Thank you for your hospitality. But my question was, I was wondering if you could comment on Canada's most recent refusal to ratify international, treaties recognizing Indigenous peoples' rights. And I'd like you to comment on basically Canada's role on a global platform, if you could. Thank you.
You want me to do it? As the...
I thought it was directed to you.
How many Indigenous people in the room, just so I can... One back there. So, I mean, I can comment on that, and this is my opinion, especially at the current time, looking at a series of how the Canadian government, I guess, has been dealing with issues that Indigenous people feel are important in Canada, one of them being the First Nations Education Act. Another one being, I guess, the response to the report, you know, by Health Canada. We had written we got a response in the form of letter, the expert panel did, you know, thanking us for our work, but not really committing to anything. That's my interpretation of this. So it's disappointing. We saw that with the initial UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People. It took a while before, you know, Canada had ratified the initial one.
After being obstructionists.
So it's disappointing. I mean, but it's not, for me, you know, this is my comment and my opinion. It's kind of currently with the government that we have in Canada, it seems to be that a lot of the issues are being neglected. That's the perspective of my people anyway. I can't speak for all Indigenous people.
I think, Colin, would you, through your work with International Indigenous Peoples and the INSTEAD organization, I hope you could comment on how you see Indigenous issues in Canada and Indigenous relationships with government in Canada versus the Pan American, South American, international context.
Yeah. The strategic opportunities for Indigenous people are so diverse, just through the Americas, never mind globally. Murray's mentioned INSTEAD. It's a research program, Indigenous Stewardship of Environment and Alternative Development. A few people in the room, including Murray and Hugo, are part of INSTEAD. And we have partners in seven countries in Latin America and in seven provinces and territories in Canada. Canada's, you know, in relative terms, is something of a bright spot. But even within Canada, the experience of our partners is so different. The Crees of Iyuwisse in northern Quebec have quite expertly used the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement in signed in the mid-1970s to get a series of successive complementary agreements and have really achieved something I would say close to a condition. Now, this was not true of the whole 40-year span that I've witnessed, but it has become true since about the late 1990s. They've achieved a condition in which it has become politically more costly for the governments of Quebec or Canada to try to impose things on the Cree than it has been to negotiate consent. So that's a very good thing. And the Crees have used that to achieve a degree of economic justice which is really beyond reach of some of our other partners, even within Canada. We also work with the Algonquins of Barrier Lake in Parc La Vérendrye, which some of you may be familiar with. And these people are, in fact, in worse conditions and more disempowered than many of our indigenous partners in Latin America. And it has to do not with any substantial difference in the legal resources available to the Algonquins, at least in theory. But in practice, they don't have capital, they don't have a strong regional organization, and they've been isolated by the governments and they've been trampled upon. Now, I think that in this era of neoconservatism that Trina has mentioned, the Harper government is an unashamed advocate of untrammeled neoliberal growth through rampant resource extractive activities, Aboriginal people, from the perspective of that political philosophy, are kind of footnotes and problems to be dealt with. And Harper began with an effort to a few token gestures and to try to kind of sweep Aboriginal people under the carpet when it came to things like the Northern Gateway Pipeline, and he had a very rude awakening. He's discovered that even a Supreme Court, which has been largely stacked now with a series of appointments by the federal government, by a conservative government, even that court has said, hang on, these people have rights. And if it was really encouraging in recent months to see the Chilcotin decision come down, which in fact is probably the clearest and strongest endorsement of Aboriginal title in Canada since at least the Delgamuukw decision in the late 1990s. So there are reasons to be optimistic in kind of the general legal perspective in Canada. Now, I'm going on too long, and Murray asked me to also mention the non-Canadian.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll go to, that's good. This questioner?
Paul Castle from the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture. We're the people to blame if your lunch is no good afterwards. But a word I've been a bit surprised not to have heard at all yet today is language. Now, we at the Syngenta Foundation have done a little bit of work on the role of minority languages, in inverted commas, in agricultural training and extension. But to me, they're so closely interrelated to the cultural identity aspects of food and food security, that I was a little bit surprised to hear in a country where I gather that Air Canada is in the doghouse for being unable to explain the onboard snack in French, that some thoughts about research going on in Canada or that you've heard of elsewhere, about which I unfortunately know nothing about, the interplay of language promotion, minority, Aboriginal language promotion, and food security. I'd be very grateful for any insights you can share on research going on in that area, here or anywhere else. Thanks.
I don't know of research that's specifically looking at language and food acquisition or, you know, language related to that. I mean, I fail to bring that point out when I show the conceptual framework that we use, but, you know, language and culture were definitely important aspects of identity and, you know, land, being on the land, having relationships with, being connected with land, all of those things are expressed in language. So definitely it's a key point. And I know that for programs where they do take youth on the land to teach them how to read the environment and to learn those practices around harvesting and preparing foods, you know, language is an important part of that. And a lot of the knowledge and concepts is transmitted that way. So it's a very important aspect. So thank you for bringing that up.
Question here.
Hello, Felix Van Gaia. I have to put my specs back on to read my notes here. By the way, just a point of definition. You talked about neoliberalism and Stephen Harper. I think really you have to say neoconservatism, because neoliberals believe in markets. There is some sense of accountability there. Neoconservatives kind of tend to believe in private wealth, private power, and basically screw the responsibility and accountability. Now, it's actually very true. Now, I'd like to pick up on the Cree principles. These are very interesting, especially if you think about terms of like a Quaker concept, or like the right relationship. So I can see that there's a right relationship here, but an awful lot of the discourse beforehand seemed to really talk more about a subsistence relationship. And I'm just wondering, if you'd like to comment on that, because I know if we talk about a global concept of agriculture, we tend to talk about how to transcend subsistence farming and actually have a greater development continuum. So I'd like to see how you juxtaposition your concepts with that idea. Thank you.
Well, the hunting in the north is the only way to, I think, for it to be a sustainable practice and one that would continues to generate social good is on what you term a subsistence basis. I'm not sure what you were getting at in terms of juxtaposing the philosophical and the kind of material economic activities within the Cree framework. The material economic activity is the fulfillment of a relationship. It is, as an anthropologist of the 1930s who worked with the Crees of Mistassini, one of the inland communities, termed it, hunting is the holy occupation of, at that time, all of the Mistassini Crees. There's a precept that much of Cree ritual and mythology involves a direct conversation with the animals or with the spirits of the animals. And there's a phrase, nitsatsak, which expresses a horizontal relationship of equality and reciprocity between the hunter and the animal. And it translates, you and I have the same flesh or bodily covering. You and I have the same soul or spirit. And so there's a great humility involved in receiving animal gifts and eventually the death of the human and the recycling of those gifts in that ecology. So people have, what sometimes from an outsider's perspective, where we're so prone to divide the sacred from the secular, it's an entirely integrated thing. It is spiritual and material simultaneously. I don't know if that gets to what you were asking.
And I'm just going to, we're quickly running out of time, and I just want to add one perspective to the discussion. We focused a lot on the questions on Indigenous peoples and the North and hunting peoples and traditional food security. And I just want to make sure there's an awareness in the room that if the concern is national, Aboriginal, or Indigenous food security, that the issue of so-labeled off-reserve natives in urban centers, southern reserves, that if you totaled up in food insecurity among Canadian Aboriginal populations, some of the numbers that Naomi was referring to would very, very much apply. So we need to be careful if we're going to equate Aboriginal food security with only traditional and remote or northern region focus. A lot of the issues that Naomi talked about in terms of poverty and food banks and inner city people absolutely applies to the same the same demographic in Canada. Question.
Thanks. Zach Rosenzweig, I'm a Lilly undergrad. I think my questions can be internationalized a little bit. Firstly, I've been thinking about, we were talking about the shift towards more modern technologies. And it seems to me there's a potential draw in the other direction away from food security when you start thinking about communities having to find means of getting cash, basically, to buy parts and to buy petrol and to make investments into these new technologies, which are becoming, it seems, more and more necessary. And then tied into that as well, we were talking about resource development, and I thought that the bits of the presentations on sort of indigenous perspectives on resource development were really valuable. But at the same time, you know, Barrick can come in and fly down Cree leaders to Guatemala and show them what great work they're doing there, allegedly. And they come back and they're big proponents of Barrick and they, you know, go through with all these mining projects. And it seems like there's a tension there between what we're hearing from the grassroots, what we're hearing from academia, what we're hearing from leadership. And you all certainly have more experience in that than me. So I was wondering if you wanted to speak on that a little. Thanks.
Yeah, well, certainly Colin has the most experience having traveled with Cree leaders to Guatemala to see mine developments in advance of actual approval of mine developments by Goldcorp within the Wiminji territory. So catch Colin at coffee. He can tell you all sorts about the inner workings of that process. I would just... it's a mixed economy in the north. That some of the most food secure households, there's an emerging phenomenon called the super provider. That in some communities, you know, 90% of traditional food is secured by 10% of people. Those 10% of people have the equipment, the experience, the know-how, the financial resources available to spend a lot of time hunting. Often those, and there's a gender issues as we've referred to in the report, but harvest still tends to get done, a lot of the larger animal harvest by males. Some of the most food secure households are those with a female wage earner and a male hunter. And the basic subsidy effect of wage economy in terms of purchase of hunting equipment, gas, Colin mentioned the use of, you know, vehicles, motorboats, is very much a part of traditional harvest activity in these communities now. So you've raised a very important point, and economic development and wealth creation within communities is part of the picture, no doubt. Maybe one more question we'd have time for.
Okay, thanks. I appreciated all the presentations very much, and I think a lot of it resonated with me. I did my PhD research in coastal Newfoundland, where I also sort of observed that kind of close connection between ecosystems change and kind of traditional food practices and local food systems. I think my question was more in response to, I think, some of the data Naomi presented, and perhaps also directed to Trina a bit, more kind of around our current, again, kind of policy environment. And I was thinking about the trends you presented in terms of household food security and insecurity in Canada, and recent changes to programs like CPP and to EI. And when you drew out the Newfoundland Labrador case, I was thinking about changes to EI and what that might mean in the context of household food security there. In particular, because there are a lot of seasonal workers. There's also been concerns about how EI changes may impact northern communities more. So I was just wondering if you could reflect generally on some of those changes in terms of the household food sort of security trends you're observing.
Sure. It's hard actually to say too much about EI. When we look at the data, the numbers that who fall into that category are much smaller, but they are a very, very vulnerable group. So when I say it's hard to look at, it's hard for us to, you know, sort of look at the relationship between severity and outcomes. But yeah, I mean, they are, after social assistance recipients, the next vulnerable group. So that's.
Great. Well, thank you very much for all the speakers and all your questions.
And my gratitude to our two co-chairs, the presenters, and the data you share with us, certainly for the future generation, which is sitting all over in this room. I'm happy to see long lines of people asking questions, and we run out of time. But there is a lot going on in McGill and at other universities in Canada and abroad on this specific topic. We'll dream about going somewhere challenging, exciting. There is a lot going on in Canada, in the north, in the cities, and around us. Thank you very much for your contribution. And we'll move on. We'll have a 10-minute break for you to stretch, to get a cup of coffee, a glass of water. I'll get back to you to introduce the second session in 10 minutes. Thanks.